Committee on Early Childhood and Family Supports to order for Thursday, April 6, 2017. So just a couple of notes about how we're going to proceed today. So I'm going to change the order of business. So we're going to first be doing a work session on House Bill 2956. And then I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3067. And then once we've completed that hearing and what action we may want to take on that bill, then we'll go back to the work session on House Bill 3087 to receive information regarding some amendments and some work that DCBS did. And then finally, we will move to House Bill 2957. Anybody have any questions about the order of business? Okay. So I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2956. Zena.
Chair Lively, members of the committee, House Bill 2956 directs the Early Learning Council to conduct an evaluation and submit a report of the Early Learning Hubs by March 15th of each odd number year. It requires the Early Learning Council to conduct an additional evaluation and report by March 2018 and declares an emergency effective on passage. The Dash 1 amendment modifies specifications of the report that is due March 2018. It eliminates an additional evaluation that is due March 2018 and eliminates the annual report that is due on or before September. There is a minimal fiscal and no revenue impact.
So just for the committee's awareness, Representative Wisnett is fine with the Dash 1 amendment, and this was his bill, and so I told him we'd go ahead and move it if I can get enough votes to do that. Anybody have any questions about the amendment? I thought there might be concerns. Please.
Chair Lively, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendment dated March 30th, 2017.
Representative Peluso moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendment dated March 30th, 2017 to House Bill 2956. Is there any discussion? Any objections to the amendment? If not, the amendment will be adopted.
Chair Lively, I move House Bill 2956 as amended to the floor with a due process recommendation.
Due process?
I mean due pass. With a process, we'll pass it.
There's the old law coming in.
That's it. I know. Okay. I know.
Okay, sorry. Representative Peluso moves House Bill 2956 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? If not, please call the roll and final passage.
Representative Bynum?
Aye.
Representative Hayden?
Excused.
Representative Huffman?
Aye.
Representative Kenny Geyer?
Aye.
Representative Malmstrom?
Excused.
Representative Brocksmith?
Excused.
Vice Chair Hack?
Excused.
Vice Chair Peluso?
Aye.
Chair Levy?
Aye. Motion carries. Okay. So we did that.
And a carrier.
Oh, sorry. And so we'll assign that to none other than Representative Wisnett to carry, I think.
There we go.
Okay. So I'm going to close the work session on 2956. And so now I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3067. Dina.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3067 directs the Department of Human Services to conduct a statewide study regarding family supports. The Dash 2 amendment proposes a pilot program to fund court care programs in Marion and Polk counties aimed at children from 6 weeks to 10 years of age. The intention is to ensure children are in safe and nurturing environment while parents and caregivers are in court proceedings and to minimize disruptions in the courtroom. House Bill Dash 2 amendment would also provide referrals and resources to social service programs for families at court care sites to help families access behavioral health services, relief, nurseries, early learning, health insurance, legal assistance, and screening and referrals for developmental health. A fiscal impact has been issued, and there's no revenue impact.
Okay. Representative Peluso, would you like to introduce a little bit about this?
I would. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This concept was brought to us by Brent DeMoe from Polk County and former Representative Betty Comp. Essentially, it would establish free child care for parents conducting business at both Marion and Polk County courthouses. Multnomah County already offers this, and it is an extremely important and effective service. There is no reason for children to be subjected to witnessing traumatizing court proceedings involving their parents. I'm excited to see everyone here to testify on this bill, and I certainly hope you all will support it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I don't see Representative Evans, but I think at some point he's going to... He's what? He's coming? Okay.
You want me to talk some more?
Well, you could. Is it going to be germane to the topic? Or?
Well, I can. Actually, you know, we did this. I am from Multnomah County. We did this in Multnomah County a handful of years ago, and truly... Our kids, our young people, should not be exposed to some of the going-ons that goes that happen in a courthouse. It's just all there is to it. And so really pleased to bring this bill forward, to have worked on it, and to see the good work in both Marion and Polk County. And we, again, Brent's right over there. Brent, I mean, has done tremendous things to make this happen. I really appreciate your work and, well, getting this to happen. It wouldn't have happened without you, so thank you very much.
So I'll go ahead and call you up, Brent, and then if Judge David, you want to come up to at the same time, and then if Representative Evans, when he gets here, we'll just let him make a few comments, if that's okay.
And I believe, Brent, you have a PowerPoint? Nope. Oh,
we're
okay.
Old school.
All right.
Okay,
like
good.
It.
We heard about this committee.
Yes. You've been warned. Good.
We're just going to talk through this.
Yeah. Just introduce yourself for the record, please.
Thank you. I've met with most of you individually. You know how much I talk, so I'm going to read my statement so I keep it under the 4 minutes. So good afternoon, Chair Lively and members of the committee. My name is Brent DeMoe. I'm the director of the Family and Community Outreach Department for Polk County. I'm really happy to be here to have an opportunity to talk about the Court Care Project and express all of our support for House Bill 3067 with the -2 amendments. So let me provide you just a little bit of background on how this coalition came to be. Last fall, partners in Marion and Polk County, including judges, district attorneys, the victim assistance programs, the CASA programs, Department of Human Services, lawyers, the Bar Association, early learning educators, and the public in general, we came together to establish Court Care in both Polk and Marion County. We started out by doing research, and as Representative Peluso said, there's only one county in Oregon out of all 36 that actually has an established Court Care program, and you'll actually get to hear from their director in a few minutes. She's here to talk about their 16-plus years of experience. So after we did some research locally, we also researched every state in the United States to find out how they did Court Care, how they established it, and we have a lot of great lessons learned, and we know the ins and outs of how to do this program. After we did that research, we started collecting data locally. Both victim assistance programs in Marion and Polk County have been collecting data for 6 months, and what they have found out is nearly 90% of every family with kids who uses the court in either Polk or Marion County would have benefited from and used Court Care if it was available. This afternoon, you will actually have an opportunity to hear from a parent who recently went through the court system in Polk County, and she was forced to bring her kids because there were no other options. You'll also have a chance to hear from one of the victim advocates in Polk County who works every day assisting families in navigating the somewhat difficult criminal justice system. So we did our research. We definitely established the need with our data. Next, we had to identify quality child care providers. So in Polk County, in the back of the room, you guys stick your hands up. Family Building Blocks will be the early learning provider for Polk County. The location, there's not room in the courthouse, but it's only 2 blocks away. And in Marion County, the YMCA couldn't be here. They had another meeting, but the YMCA will be providing the child care, and that is just 1 block away from the courthouse. Both of these programs are already licensed by the state. We've already identified space. We have most of the equipment ready to go, and they're high-quality early learning programs. So because we've laid this foundation prior to coming to you, we are quite literally turnkey ready with just a small bit of jumpstart funding from the legislature. Our official ask is for $200,000 for the biennium. That's $50,000 per year per county for 2 years. And that's primarily just going to go to staffing. We have the rest covered. We've raised money ourselves as well. We have over $25,000 cash raised, and the in-kind contributions are more than triple that. So we want this to be a 2-year pilot project, and both of these sites are going to collect extensive data for you, and the bill outlines that a little bit. We're going to collect this data, and we'll share it with every other county in the state so they have a glide path on how to do this program if they choose to do it too. And I think it's important for you guys to know, we don't want to come to the legislature every session and ask you for money. Our research in other states, we have already found a funding mechanism that we'll bring to you next session. It will not take any general fund, and it will not take any money from any existing program. It's a new way to fund court care based on what other states do. You'll like that. The other component of court care that I think is important is the ability to connect families to much-needed resources and referrals. In Polk County, where the court care facility is going to be, it's in our building called the Academy Building. It's where all the county services are. It's also the Polk County Resource Center, which co-locates over 5 nonprofit organizations. Every social service you could think of is a one-stop shop in our building, and court care will be across the hall. So we can connect those families to much-needed resources. At the YMCA, all of those staff will also be trained how to do referrals in Marin County and Salem. There will be brochures and all of the resource information available at both sites. So in closing, you may have noticed that a lot of people are wearing blue, right? Well, this is the perfect time for this bill because right now it's Child Abuse Prevention Month and blue is that color. This week specifically is National Crime Victim Rights Week. So we are all wearing blue to raise awareness for both of those things. So thank you for the opportunity to speak. You might have some questions, but if it pleases you, I know there's some other folks that are going to talk. They might actually say the specifics that you want, and I'm happy to come back up and answer specific questions if you'd like. Thank you.
Very much, and you're to be commended with all the people you work with for bringing this so quickly to yes. to us and with bringing options, which is refreshing, I think, for all of us that serve on this committee and others. So thank you very much, Brent.
You bet. This coalition is awesome. These guys are movers and shakers.
Obviously, yes. Representative Evans, would you like to
testify? Thank you, Chair Lively, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Paul Evans. I represent House District 20. With respect to Representative Huffman, one of the ends of the Oregon Trail. I also just want to, before I begin with my remarks, it'll be very brief. I want to say that you're absolutely right about Mr. DeMeau and his leadership abilities. He is one of the spark plugs in Polk County that we would not be having much of the things that are going well right now in Polk County without him involved. And if anybody tries to take him, well, just that won't happen. We want to keep him here. I also want to thank Vice Chair Peluso for making this bill possible so quick. A lot of people probably don't care, and a lot of people certainly don't know this, but in the 1980s, my mom worked for a district attorney in Polk County by the name of Doug Dawson. And those were not great times in Oregon, as you remember, in the 1980s in terms of the recession, et cetera. And the impact of having kids involved in the court process was something that struck me then and continues to be an issue. There are things that no person should ever see, and there are certainly things that children shouldn't have to be exposed to, especially after a crime. And the thing that is the most compelling part about this package of suggestions and an approach is that it is truly a combination of good policy and just the right thing to do. It, number one, in this effort, in this pilot program, will provide an option for parents that are already going under stress and just the associated activities and concerns and anxieties associated with the court process. And at the same time, because of the, quite frankly, masterful planning on the part of Brent and his team, have an opportunity to do assessments and get the kids involved in the services that may actually not just help them but their families long-term as well, and in many cases get folks out of the cycle of violence that they find themselves in. In this building, as we all know, there are a number of bills that are promises. There are a number of bills that are bridges to good outcomes. It is seldom that such a small-priced pilot program will truly change the lives of people and affect children, quite frankly, overnight once it starts. And that's why I'm a complete supporter of this bill and grateful for the opportunity to be a part. I know our budget is not easy, but this is one of those situations where I firmly believe that with a little bit of help here, Brent will not only be coming back in 2 years not asking for money, but quite frankly, showcasing to other counties and other communities what lessons have been learned and how to be successful there as well. So I'll close my comments with just asking you to proceed with this bill, and I'm grateful for the opportunity for you to hear it today.
Thank you, Representative Evans.
Chair Lively, yes. Members of the committee.
My name is David Leith. I'm one of your circuit court judges here in Marion County. I am speaking in my individual capacity today and not on behalf of the Oregon Judicial Department. And first, let me say, I'm not very good at being color-coded. I totally forgot to do that. It does not mean that I don't support the bill. I do. And I was going to say, I think that if you look closely, you'll find
some blue there.
I saw that.
Maybe I don't need it after all. The circuit courts of the state routinely hear matters that are as others have said, wholly inappropriate for child tears. For example, we hear immediate danger petitions where one parent is expressing concern and alleging circumstances that make the other parent dangerous to the child or the children, either because of abuse or neglect or other circumstances. The cases often recount facts that would traumatize or even re-traumatize the child, if the child may even have been present when the alleged incident occurred. Courts also routinely hear eviction matters where a family may be on the verge of homelessness. Emotions run high in those cases, and again, it would be traumatic for a child to listen to the emotional adversary proceedings where the parents are trying to argue in favor of avoiding that brink of homelessness. These parents often arrive at the courthouse, children in tow, and not because they're oblivious to how inappropriate it is for the children to hear those materials, but because they simply don't have any realistic, better options. So they bring the kids to the courthouse, and they bring the kids into the courtroom, and the court judge looks out and says, wait a second, and tries to figure out whether there isn't a better option, talks to the parties about that, confirms that there really isn't, and the court then faces its own series of sort of set of bad options, and a judge may create a makeshift solution where you might ask your staff to stand in as daycare, which obviously has downsides that the circuit court state and the state court administrator would consider to be impossible. It probably happens anyway sometimes. Or you know, among the bad options is the children just have to listen to the proceeding, and that certainly happens as well. And that's where court care comes in. Providing accessible, both in terms of financially accessible and also convenient daycare for litigants while they're in court, while they're dealing with the issues that would be traumatic for the children to participate in. And it's safe. The parent doesn't have to worry about the child, and it's appropriate in every way. The child care is licensed, and the parent can pick the child back up after the matter is resolved, however it goes. So it's an important program, as has been said. Multnomah County's program works well. We're trying hard to put together a program in Marion County. Right now, we're, as Brent has described, in Polk County. Marion County has some funding in place now, but not nearly enough to get started. And this is the jump start that would be needed to lift the program off the ground. As in Polk County, the Y is ready to go, and we would I believe be ready to go on July 1, if not soon after, if the funding was here. So, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Any questions for either of these? Thanks again so much for coming tonight. So, okay. So next, I'm going to call. Is it Kiri Height? There she is, and Michelle Ward. and Natalie Lucy. Thank you all for being here, and if you would just make sure you introduce yourself for the record before you begin. Thank you. Whoever wants
Good
to
afternoon,
first.
Representative Lively and Committee. My name is Michelle Ward, and I'm with Volunteers of America, and I operate and oversee the Multnomah County Court Care Program. I've had the honor of helping set up and run the program for the last 15 years. We used a trauma-informed approach to care, and 95% of all our families are coming to us in crisis, and 90% reported they had no alternate forms of child care available to them. Before the program opened, it wasn't uncommon to have courtrooms filled with children, children who should not be hearing or witnessing details of the courts. The children in the courtroom also impacted the court's ability, as well as the parents, to access justice. Our program is not only a safe space for children, but for their parents and caregivers as well. It is an environment where they can build trust, and often we become a foundation for these families in crisis and are able to link them with additional resources. Over half the families served are women who are coming to obtain restraining orders. It's not uncommon to have children come in the morning in their pajamas, often tired and hungry. We have a clothing closet available. We're able to give them a clean change of clothes and feed them. The program is a success, and we've served over 15,000 children. And because of the Court Care Agency, other programs in the Providence Health System and the Gateway Domestic Violence Center have come to us about opening similar programs, which are opening and running successfully. And in April of 2015, we opened a second court care program in the East County Courthouse. The impact this service has on families is literally life-changing. A mother who used our services after returning from her hearing had tears in her eyes. She explained that she had called the crisis line the night before. She'd put off obtaining her restraining order because she had no safe place for her children. She told us through her tears that we literally saved her life by allowing her to come get the restraining order and have her children in a safe spot. And this is why I'm here today to ask you for your support of HB House Bill 3067 to protect children and to promote justice. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Chair Lively and everybody else. My name is Kiri Height, and I am from Polk County, Grand Ronde. I have two children, and just recently, you know, I wrote this letter because I was going to read it, but everybody kind of touched base on everything I've said already in my letter, so I'm just going to tell you. I was told I didn't have to tell my story about exactly what happened, but I think I want to. So I went to court and I brought my children because I didn't have anywhere to take them, and it was a last minute thing. And Lisa asked me if I would come and speak to you guys about it. It was a domestic violence case, and there was a lot of emotional abuse with my kids, involved with it. And I did feel like I couldn't really ask the judge what I wanted to ask her and tell her what I wanted to say because my kids were there. So I kind of tippy-toed around my words very carefully because my kids were present. And you know what? The impact of what I could have said could have been a different outcome that day. But, you know, and obviously the kids should not be in a courtroom and shouldn't be exposed to that. But also, I was just in court just last Tuesday without the kids. And there was three other families there that had their kids in the courtroom. And so I'm kind of seeing it from two different perspectives. It was very distracting. I couldn't even hear the judge speaking because the kids were kind of loud and irritating everybody in the courtroom. So I think this is a great idea, and I would definitely use it if, unfortunately, I would have to go back to court. I would definitely use that service.
Thank you very much for coming and testifying.
You're welcome. So, Chair Lively, Vice Chair Paluzzo, and all the members of the committee. My name is Natalie Lucy, and I am the Person Crimes Advocate for Polk County District Attorney's Office. As an advocate, I provide support through the prosecution of a case for victims of child abuse, stalking, elder abuse, sexual assault, domestic violence, and homicide. I also provide services to victims of other types of violent and traumatic crimes. My goal as an advocate is to provide or arrange for services to meet the material, emotional, and informational needs experienced by victims, thereby
allowing for faster and more complete recovery from the effects of crime. Daily, I attend court proceedings and meet with victims of violent and traumatic crimes. These victims walk in my door with a wide range of emotions, many questions, and oftentimes their kids. The conversations I have with victims about trauma, anxiety, fear, and rape are not ones that should be heard by little ears. Children are smart and perceptive. They know when mom is sad, and they know when something is wrong. Subjecting these children to listen to those types of conversation is not something I enjoy doing. Therefore, when a child is present, I try hard to control the conversation and make it as child-appropriate as I can. That, in turn, makes it difficult for me to be an effective advocate. In my personal experience of advocacy, I have witnessed children comfort their parents, including a 3-year-old that walked up to her mother and laid a hand on her as she sobbed. I have been in a courtroom watching children hang on to every word that their parent is saying about the offender and about the offense. I have held a baby for a mother so that she could attend the trial regarding the death of her older child. I am often the only support person for these victims, offering them not only emotional support, but child support as well. Our program would greatly benefit from court care so that we can more effectively provide and arrange for services to meet the needs of these victims. More importantly, the victims we serve and their children need court care. Parents need a safe place they can take their children while they deal with their court business for a faster and more complete recovery so they can, in turn, work on being healthy, stable, the healthy and stable parent that their children need. For those reasons, I too encourage you to pass the House Bill 3067. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today.
Thank you very much. Any questions?
Doesn't look like it. Again, thank you very much for taking the time to testify. Next up, I have District Attorney Felton and Catherine Denning. Welcome.
Chair Lively, Vice Chair Peluso, members of the committee. My name is Aaron Felton. I am the district attorney for Polk County, and I'm here speaking in favor of House Bill 3067 and urging your adoption of the -2 amendments. Thank you very much for allowing this opportunity to appear before you today. Those who have come before speaking to you have spoken far more eloquently than I can in terms of their personal experiences in the courtroom. I've been an attorney, counted up a little over 20 years now, and in the courtroom most of that time, and I share those experiences, whether as a prosecutor, I was a defense attorney, and did some civil practice as well. Whether it's in a criminal case, a domestic relations case, a juvenile dependency case, I've been in the courtroom with parents and children. And it hurts your heart to see children going through these experiences. For all the reasons people have said before you today, children should never have to hear these things. So I'm grateful for this opportunity to have this legislation before you. When I first met with Brent, I don't know, it's almost a year now since we started talking, it was almost an epiphany because I thought, thank goodness, finally something has come along to address this issue. Because it will do so much just to remove this small impediment to what happens in our courtrooms nearly every day when parents, through no fault of their own, whether economic circumstances or choice beyond their control, have been compelled to bring their children. This will provide a place where children go that's safe and nurturing for their children so they can address their important business in the courtroom. I will tell you, too, as a prosecutor, part of my obligation is to bring people to justice, to hold them accountable. But once we have gotten there, part of my obligation as well is to help them be accountable by taking away an obstacle to help them become accountable. Very often people are placed on probation, ordered by the court to satisfy certain conditions of probation. One of the things I've found in my own personal experience is that sometimes people are not able to meet their conditions of probation because they don't have either transportation or child care. This is a way we can provide an opportunity, a location for people coming to Polk County, getting services, whether it's to meet with their PO, whether it's to come to a class, whether it's even to give a UA, where they've said, I can't do it because I don't have childcare. Now we would be able to say, we have a place for you. We have somewhere that's safe, that's available, so you can take care of your child, meet the obligation to your child, and then come take care of your business so you can meet your obligations, get off of probation, become a productive member of society, and meet your obligations. I feel very good about that because that's part of my obligation as well. So it's good for the parents, and it's good for public safety as well. So I urge your yes vote on the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 3067. Thank you so much for giving us this opportunity.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Lively. Chairman Lively, excuse me, Representative Palooza, and everyone else here today, thank you so much for listening to all of us. I'm a family law practitioner in Marion and Polk County, and I wanted to share with the committee how my area of law is affected by the lack of low-income available child care in our communities.
Can you state your name for the record, please?
Catherine Denning,
excuse me.
So we've heard a lot of people speak eloquently today about how children are negatively affected in this matter, how parents are negatively affected, and how the bench and the judicial staff is negatively affected. These are all very good reasons to support this measure. I imagine right now finding money in a budget is a difficult thing to do for a social program. So I want to speak for another group that is affected by this measure, and that is the people who can afford to hire family law attorneys like me and other people in the community are usually middle income or higher income people. They are negatively affected by this measure as much as anyone else on the bench in the community. Children are. Here's an example of why that is. We go to what's called status conferences in Marion and Polk County. The attorneys go for the client. Self-represented litigants have to go and represent themselves at that time. They often bring children. And what happens, in my experience, is that the judge will cancel that hearing and reschedule it to another time. Obviously, we have preserved for these children a very important opportunity to not hear the details. We've negatively affected that parent, of course, who took time off work. We've now negatively affected my client, though, also, who has had to pay for my services to go to the courthouse to have the hearing rescheduled to another time. Everyone is financially as well as emotionally losing by not having affordable child care for litigants in these communities. And Brent has done a lot of great work in organizing a very cost-effective, ready-to-go program for you. That's all I have to say. I'm happy to answer more questions. I just really wanted to share that I know it's hard to find money in a budget, but that people, taxpayers of all income levels, will be positively affected, I believe, by this program.
Great. Thank you. Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Chair Lively. Sounds like a really good program, and as somebody that has engaged with child care for several wards of the court, going through this process, I'm sympathetic to that. I could afford that myself, but many can't. when we talk about, and my question would be, how would you see the administrative rule being set up? This seems to include people doing any government activities, like is that going to the DMV to get their license corrected? Is that going down to apply for unemployment benefits? What sideboards do you see around this as far as folks coming and utilizing that service that might put more burden on it that it could handle in a pilot project and kind of push out some of the ones that it was intended for? I mean, how do you see controlling that?
I see Brent DeMoe coming up right now to help answer the question, but Chair Lively, Vice Chair Peluso, and Representative Hayden, I will tell you from my desire is although I've talked about it happening in the courtroom in my own sphere of work, I've always thought of this as something to be expanded to allow people who may be mandated under other programs, whether it's going to comply with perhaps some sort of behavioral health type of program they're on or some other type of county social service program, so that they could, because they have children too, clearly, and that can be an impediment to them complying with that program as well. So I've thought it in a broader concept as well, if that could fit within the portfolio of the program. So, Mr. DeMoe, do you?
Well, just to follow up on that, just very quickly,
sure,
to follow up on that, maybe I'm reading this wrong, but it appears that this amendment, the dash two or whatever dash it is, would allow that.
Yes.
I mean, because it talks about transacting local government business. Most of those have some sort of government involvement, even if it's with behavioral health, mental health. I mean, Oregon Health Plan is government involvement, no? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a government program. So, anyway, go ahead.
Please introduce yourself again, Mr. Bond.
Thank you. This is Brent Demo again from Polk County, Chair Lively, members of the committee, Representative Hayden. Let me answer that very specifically. Have you ever heard anyone say that there's a difference between all the counties in Oregon, maybe even a difference between Marion and Polk County? I don't know. I could be guessing here, but you may have heard that.
36 differences.
So trying to write a bill that could incorporate and encompass many different avenues, we wanted to be as all-encompassing as we could. So let me be very specific to the pilot project. In Polk County, we anticipate, we don't have as many trials, and we don't have as many judges and as many courtrooms as they do in Marion County. And we are very certain that our model, which will be called court and community care, could be open for anyone who has that type of appointment, those things you just mentioned. In the academy building that I told you about, we have people that are coming to sign up for OHP. They're coming to get rental assistance. They have an addiction counseling appointment, those types of things. They would have the same ability as room allowed to sign up for use of this program. In Marion County, there are, I think, 14 judges. If you count all of them, there's a lot. There's between 13 and 14, I was told. The starting out in Marion County is going to be for court care purposes only. Anyone who has a appointment or any kind of court-related business, including being a juror, if you get called for jury duty and you don't have regular child care and you suddenly have to go serve on grand jury or even a trial, you're going to be able to use this too. As we look at usage and who's using it and how much, we want to, one, expand hours and days, and two, expand availability depending on the need. In Polk County, we're geared up. We know we can open it up to anyone who has an appointment, whether it's government-related or any of the other social services I mentioned. In Marion County, we're going to start with filling the need for court care first, and if there's other room available, we will take that as well.
Good answer. Any other questions members have? Thanks for coming back up, and thanks for
thank you all.
Testifying. So that's all the people I have on my list. Representative Peluso, did you?
Yeah, if I could. I want to, again, thank everybody who's here, everybody who has helped and worked on this. Michelle, I have it right, correct? I was there 17 years ago at Multnomah County, and I appreciate your longevity. That's excellent. Thank you so much. I also, Brett beat me to talking about Child Abuse Awareness Month here in April, and I always like to say, so when I was in law enforcement, I did child abuse and crimes as part of my duties as a detective, and I always want to remind people that child abuse does not always require bruises or markings. It's the emotional abuse that takes place, and I think that's one thing that this court care is going to be so instrumental in. And within every program we're going to do, there will be a prevention component as well, as we either strengthen the needs of our children, but as well as our parents and our families, so that, you know, this stuff doesn't happen. So I just need to say I was honored to be asked to deal with this. I'm really pleased to be associated with it and associated with all of you who are making this happen. This is really, really important stuff. And so thanks so much. We'll see if we can make this pass.
Okay.
Went over there.
Oh. Representative Kenny Geyer.
Thank you. Quick comment and question. I've known the Multnomah County Court Care as well when we funded it through Hannah Anderson Children's Foundation a long time ago. But I love this program. And my question is, where are other counties? Are there other counties who are wanting to do this as well? Is it just that Marion and Polk are the farthest along, and so you're kind of next in line for this? Thank you, Brett.
Hey, Brent Demo again. How you doing? Chair Lively, Representative Kenny Geyer. when I get on a project, I happen to work pretty quick. So when I heard about this, I mean, we have done a lot of work in a short amount of months. Since we've started to raise awareness about this, a lot of other counties are saying, mm-hmm. how do we do that? It really is a need in every courtroom in Definitely. Oregon, if not the whole United States. Mm-hmm. There are models from other states. They're way ahead of us. They actually require this to be in every courtroom. Mm-hmm. Other states are bringing it on slowly. And I think what we thought was, because we were so ready in Marion and Polk, and we literally... You guys find a way to get this through Ways and Means, and don't let it die there. Take some money from the DHS budget is my humble opinion. It's only $200,000. Child welfare can spare it. I've talked to them. We can do this.
No, they can't spare it.
A little
get
bit
it from somewhere else.
Benefiting their kids, they're probably going to be one of our number one clients yeah. is for those folks. So we can compromise there. But I think it really is what you said. Polk and Marion are so ready to go. We can start July 1 if we know the funding's coming. And then we will provide that data for other counties and a glide path literally on how to do this. The data we're going to collect is not only is the courtroom more efficient, how many referrals did we have, but what kinds of, was it family law, what kinds of users used it, and we're going to provide all that data, and we're going to give that to you guys, every report that you ask for, and I think people will be able to just say, okay, let's take the pieces from urban and the pieces from rural, depending on our county, and let's make it work here. Yamhill County is already talking about this. They're in the beginning stages of planning their early learning council, and I've met with their county commissioner. They're looking at doing this three box from their courtroom once the funding is available in 2 years.
Thank you. Just to follow up on that, when we had our original conversations, the goal is ultimately to get this throughout the entire state. This is the going to be the prototype.
Great.
Thanks a lot.
So I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3067. Members, are you comfortable with me opening the work session and moving this bill since we haven't had a chance to talk about it? Okay, I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3067. And just so members know that this will be referred to Joint Ways and Means, and I would just remind members, once we're through these timelines, we'll be talking about our priorities for Joint Ways and Means, and I would hope this might be one of them given the low amount of money. And the good you can do, we'll get a chance to talk about it from that range, too.
What's the money? Because I didn't see that in the fiscal.
$200,000. $200,000,
yes.
So, Representative
Peluso? Okay. Let's see, where am I?
We have to adopt the amendment first.
Yeah, and did you open the work session?
Dash two. Yes, I did open the work session.
There you go.
Chair
Lively, I move to adopt the Dash 2 amendment dated March 31st, 2017.
So Representative Peluso moves to adopt the Dash 2 amendment dated March 31st, 2017 to House Bill 3067. Is there any discussion? Any objection to the amendment? If not, the amendment has been approved. Representative Peluso.
Chair Lively, I move House Bill 3067 as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Representative Peluso moves House Bill 3067 as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, please call the roll.
Representative Bynum?
Aye.
Representative Hayden?
Aye.
Representative Hoffman?
Aye.
Representative Kenny Geyer?
Aye.
Representative Malmstrom?
Excused.
Representative Brock Smith?
Excused.
Vice Chair Hack?
Excused.
Vice Chair Peluso?
Aye.
Chair Lively?
Aye. Motion carries. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3067. And Representative Hayden, we passed House Bill 2956 before you were here. So if you'd like to vote on it, we can have a suspension of the rules and allow you to vote on that measure.
Sure.
Okay. Anybody?
I move to suspend the rules, Mr. Chair, for the purpose of allowing Rep. Hayden to vote on 3067.
2956.
I like both those bills. 2956.
Is there any objection to suspending the rules to allow Representative Hayden to vote on 2956?
2956.
Okay. If not, Representative Hayden, how do you vote?
Aye.
Thank you very much. Okay. So now we're going to go back to House Bill 3087. I'll open a work session on House Bill 3087, and the purposes today for this work session is to hear about the amendment and get a report from DCBS on the financial aspects. So, do I have a sheet or what's the story here? Kate.
Kate and Teresa.
Kate and Teresa. Okay. Welcome.
Thank you. Myself organized here. Thank you, Chair Lively, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kate Newhall, and I'm here today testifying on behalf of Family Forward Oregon. I want to thank you for allowing this opportunity for us to come in and give you a more detailed overview of the paid family and medical leave insurance proposal. You have before you in OLIS the Dash 1 amendments. These are amendments that are prepared as a gut and stuff, but are primarily technical in nature and are necessary to achieve the original intent of the Paid Family and Medical Leave Insurance Program, or FAMLI, known by its acronym. For my testimony today, I will be going through the Dash 1s as a reference point, and when I refer to sections and provisions of House Bill 3087, it will actually be the Dash 1 amendments. Before I get started, I do just want to say thank you and express my appreciation for all of the agencies that have been working with us to get this draft to a place where it does, I think, achieve the intent of what we're trying to do here. It's been many months of working on this draft and many versions of the bill draft to review and language. And I think there are a number of areas where the feedback of DCBS, Revenue, the Employment Department, and BOLI have been hugely invaluable and are definitely appreciated. Many of the changes that are in the Dash 1 amendments are, in fact, to address the technical issues that the agencies had raised. And we do know and expect that we'll have another amendment coming, the Dash 2 amendments. And as I go through this, I will try and identify places where we know another change is to be expected. So before I go through the section-by-section overview, I just want to draw your attention to a handout that is in OLIS, but I also asked for it just to be distributed out so folks could have it in front of them, which is this timeline of the Paid Family Medical Leave program and when different portions of the program will become operative and the program will sort of roll out. So the first piece that would happen is the bill being signed by the governor, and then I'm going to sort of go through how it would come online after that. So the first phase we call the startup phase, and that's what happens after the bill becomes effective, and it would become effective 90 days after sine die. And sections 1, 15, 16, and 18 would become operative in this phase one. And it would essentially allow the establishment of the family fund. It would allow DCBS and the other agencies to start rulemaking and doing the program development pieces that they need to do for when the program does fully come online. For example, the Department of Revenue doing updates to its combined payroll reporting form and adding the payroll contributions for the family benefits onto that. And there would also be rulemaking happening through this phase. The second phase of the program will begin in January 1 of 2019, and that would be when the payroll contributions start being collected from both employers and employees. And because we have always wanted to design this program as a program that is completely self-sustaining and doesn't require any sort of general fund appropriation for startup or administration, the program would not actually start administering benefits until January 1 of 2021. Although if the fund gets to a place of solvency with an adequate reserve in it, DCBS does have the authority to start administering benefits prior to that January 1, 2021 phase. I skipped a phase here in the middle because it's a phase three is a report back phase where we're asking DCBS and the other agencies to come and make a report back to the legislature on their progress in implementing the program. So the last phase, phase four, is when the benefits at the latest will begin being administered and payable to individuals filing a paid family and medical leave claim. So I just thought that was a helpful sort of way to sketch out, here's the points in time as the various components of it do come online. So now I'm just going to walk through, and I'm going to try and do this fairly quickly but also thoroughly because I don't want to be missing pieces that we've changed or leave anything out. So the first section. Where we did changes is in section one. And the major changes in the definitions to the section are two. The first one was to revise the definition of family member to better achieve what we had originally intended in our drafting of the concept, and to include family members who are both covered under the definition for Oregon Family Medical Leave Act, but then also to include individuals related by blood and affinity. This is a standard that has been used by the Office of Personnel Management for federal employees for many, many years now, and recognizes the diverse family structures that exist, and that it often includes both blood relatives as well as chosen family members. The second substantial change in the definitions is to break out definitions of who is a covered individual, and then covered individual can also include an eligible employee and a self-employed individual who has opted into the program. So we had to sort of break out those three different definitions, because later throughout the draft, sometimes it's necessary to refer to a covered individual being both self-employed and an eligible employee, or just one or the other. So I will say a lot of the kind of following changes throughout are to make sure that we're getting those two pieces right and who we're referencing. Section 2 did not really have any change in it. It's the section that spells out the eligibility for benefits. So essentially, what are the qualifying conditions that you can take paid family medical leave insurance benefits under? And that would be parental leave, an individual's own serious health condition, a family member's serious health condition, or military leave, or any of the provisions that are covered in OFLA, the Oregon Family Leave Act. Section 3 is the duration of benefits. So this is how long can someone claim benefits for. Again, not really any major change in this section. And what it allows for is 12 weeks of paid leave for any of the qualifying conditions, and then an additional 6 weeks of time that can only be used for parental leave. So if an individual were taking parental leave, they could qualify for up to a total of 18 weeks of time. I will say there was one little change here to allow an employee to opt, or a self-employed person to opt, to end their benefits sooner than the amount of time that they qualify for. So if an individual doesn't want to take all the time that's available to them, they're not forced to take it. Section 4 is the amount of benefits section. And I just want to spend a little bit of time here talking about the wage replacement formula and how we came to it and why we came to it. So the benefit replacement will always be based on a percentage of what the state's average weekly wage is. So that's a number that the Employment Department determines, and it's essentially what does an average working Oregonian make in a week. I think when I handed out the example, I'm using 2015 number for what is that average weekly wage. But what we wanted to do is create a wage replacement scale that allowed for lower income individuals to get a higher percentage of their income, and then a sort of decreasing percentage of overall income as the individual's income increased. So what we've done is to create a wage replacement scale of, you would get 90% of your wages up to that average weekly wage, and then for wages that you earned above average weekly wage, you would get 50% of your wages up to a cap, and the cap that we set in the Dash 1 amendments is $1,200. I will say DCBS has very helpfully pointed out that by the time the program becomes operational in 2021, that the average weekly wage is likely to be close to $1,100 a week. So they made the suggestion that that we have taken in the next coming amendment, that we tie the cap to a percentage, again, of average weekly wage, and the equivalent percentage for the $1,200 cap that we're trying to achieve in, again, what is $2015, would be 130% of average weekly wage. So nobody would ever be able to make more than 130%. I have handed out for you just a couple different income levels to show what an individual's hourly wage would be and what that individual making $11.50 an hour would make in a weekly wage, what their annual wage would be, and then what their weekly contribution amounts would be, and what their benefit projection would be. And then at the very last column, it sort of goes through to show what is the overall percentage of that individual's income that they would be expecting in the wage replacement formula. And I think it does. Our hope was to be creating a wage replacement scale that avoided any cliff effect. And I think this model does do that quite nicely. So that's section four. Section five is the contribution section. We did not make any change to the contribution amounts of 0.5% paid both by the employer and the employee for what would be a 1% contribution on overall payroll, shared equally again by the employer and the employee. DCVS has the authority to adjust this percentage down or anywhere below 0.5% from the employer and the employee. And our intent there was we wanted to make sure that we were charging a premium that was sufficient to be funding the program, but that we weren't creating a huge amount of surplus in it. I will say you'll hear from a moment in from DCBS around their cost projections on what this will be, and they are projecting that this will be under the 1% threshold. And I do like that because it allows some flexibility in there if something ever happens to be off in the projections. There are several technical changes in this contribution section that I will say are entirely from the Department of Revenue and are related to their ability to collect and then disperse the payroll assessments and for their being able to collect them from employers. And also wanting to make sure that those collection provisions were consistent with their other collection authority ability. That's what I have to say about Section 5. Section 6 is our benefits for reduced leave. This is a section that allows for family leave benefits to be payable for intermittent leave. For example, someone who has ongoing caregiving needs that only come up 1 or 2 days a week, or someone who has a need for ongoing regular medical care like a dialysis, something like that. Paid leave in these instances would only be available in 8-hour chunks of time, and they would be required to be scheduled and taken on a regular and predictable basis. For example, the aging parent, if an individual had a parent that they needed to provide care for 2 days a week, say Tuesdays and Thursdays, they had other siblings that did the care on the other weeks, they would be able to get benefits for those 2 days. But we do want to make sure that the benefits are only payable in week increments. We don't want to put DCBS in a situation where they're issuing checks for just 1 day here and 1 day there. So we will have amendments coming that clarify that the benefits are only going to be payable in increments of 40 hours. So essentially, you would have to have 5 days that you were out before that check would be paid. Section 7 is the notice to the employer. Again, we didn't have any significant change to this section from the original version of the bill. It requires a 30 days notice be given to an employer before leave is taken if the need for leave is foreseeable. For example, I think it's completely reasonable to have 30 days notice if an individual is pregnant. You know what beyond 30 days that you're going to be having a baby. Sometimes the same with surgeries that are scheduled with more than 30 days notice, you can give that notice. We do allow a provision for when the need for leave is unforeseeable, like an immediate accident or injury. And then in that instance, the notice needs to be given as soon as is practicable. We will be adding a provision in the next amendment, however, that allows for someone who has an unexpected injury or illness and then is not able to file a claim. What do you do in that instance? We actually look to California, and the way that they handle instances like this is if someone, say, is in a car accident and then they're in intensive care in the hospital, can't file a claim but still are qualified, to allow the claim to be backdated to the date of the injury or illness, but also require that that individual file the claim within 45 days of the injury happening. Section 8 and Section 9 are similar. Again, no changes were really made to these sections. This is the leave and employment protections and the prohibiting retaliatory actions. So essentially that an employee can't be fired or have any adverse employment action taken against them because they need leave, because they inquire about leave. I will say there's a possibility these sections are similar and related, that these two will be combined in the next amendment. It just makes sense for ease of reading. Section 10 is coordination of benefits. This section essentially spells out how other benefits will interact with other leave laws and collective bargaining agreements. It's our intent that family leave benefits would run concurrently with any other protected leave if an individual is eligible for both of them. So essentially, if you're eligible for OFLA, you're also eligible for family leave benefits, that you would be drawing on both of those banks simultaneously. This section also spells out that collective bargaining agreements could go above the floor set in state laws, but you wouldn't have an ability to negotiate below this threshold outlined in 3087. We also want to guarantee that employees won't lose employment benefits like their health insurance when they're out on family leave benefits, and this is consistent with both OFLA and FEMLA, that you can't drop health insurance while you're out on protected leave. Section 11 is the notice to employees. Again, we didn't really do any changes to this section. What we envision in this notice that employers would have to give to employees is a posting requirement, a poster that DCBS would put together that would be hung in workplaces, that would both notify an employee of their rights, but also how they would need to be filing a claim. Section 12 is enforcement, and there is a small change to this section to require that if ever there is a contested case or a dispute coming either from the employer or the employee, that those disputes would be handled by the Office of Administrative Hearings. This section also has a provision to allow DCBS to share protected information with other agencies that might be necessary to administer the program. I will say in the amendment that's coming, we are adding more specific provisions around protecting that health record information from public record disclosure. But we do want to make sure that the agencies, as they're administering and working together, are able to share that information. Section 13 deals with noncompliance and erroneous payments. So this is if either an employer is not providing accurate information about the amount of time that an employee is away from work to DCBS when they request it. It also deals with if an employee has made a willful misrepresentation in filing a benefit and then thus, as a result, erroneously gets benefits. We want to make sure that there's enforcement provisions for that. If an employee does make that kind of willful misrepresentation, they would both be required to pay back the benefits and would be barred from claiming family benefits for a year. Section 14 is the self-employment opt-in. Again, this is a provision that doesn't come online until 2021, and I think there's good reason for a lot of that decision. I think there are some areas that we do want to flesh out a little bit more around how to assess self-employment income, what's the right number to be using, what's the right premium contribution for the self-employed individuals to be making, and what should the right benefit to those folks be. So a little bit later down in the bill, when we asked, when DCBS has the requirement to report back, we are also going to require them to specifically come back and make detailed recommendations on how best to implement that self-employed opt-in and what the contributions and benefits should be. I will say in the change that's coming, because we didn't have at this point answers to those questions, the amendment is going to allow DCBS to set the contribution and benefit rate by rule. But my expectation is that before the self-employment option would come online, we would have good recommendations from DCBS on how best to approach that. Section 15 is just general administration. This allows DCBS to enter into interagency agreements with other agencies to administer parts of the fund. There is an amendment that will be coming where our intent was to allow DCBS to work with other agencies to administer the fund, but not necessarily contract with private entities for administering the fund. So we will strike that language. This section also requires other agencies to assist DCBS in the education, the outreach, and the training around the fund when requested. So if, for example, another agency was doing some sort of mass mailing to all employers to potentially include something like this around it. Section 16 creates the Family Fund. So this is the fund that would be used for the ongoing costs, administration of the program, and to administer the family leave benefits. It also precludes family monies from being used on other programs, just for the fund. Section 17 is the reports that I was referenced earlier, and this requires DCBS to make its first report on January 1 of 2020, and then every 2 years thereafter. We are going to be adding in the amendment more specific direction around the self-employed individuals and their opt-in provision. Section 18 is just sharing technology. There may be additional amendments to this section, but essentially it's encouraging DCBS to use existing data collection and technology wherever possible so that we're not reinventing the wheel when we don't have to. For example, a lot of the wage information that we're using is actually coming from the Employment Department and unemployment insurance data on how much an employee has made, what's their wage history. Section 19 is aligning with Oregon Family Leave Act. This section essentially reduces the waiting period for OFLA from 180 days to 90 days. And the reason that we wanted to reduce this timeline is because we felt like it was important for an individual to be able to take paid family leave benefits, even if they had started with a new employer, and to take them before a six-month period. We feel like if someone has been paying into this fund for many, many years, they shouldn't be precluded from accessing it just because they've recently started employment with a new employer. We felt like 30 days was still longer than we wanted, but probably a much more reasonable approach. Section 20 is the enforcement provisions for just the retaliation pieces. So the Bureau of Labor and Industry's only real role in this program is to enforce those employment protections. All of the other enforcement would be done by DCBS and the Department of Revenue. So Section 20 just gives BOLI the authority to enforce those two retaliation and job protection sections. Section 21 is the operative dates of the various components of the family program. So again, I'll just refer you back to the timeline of when the different sections come online and become operative. But essentially, there is an effective date of 90 days after the bill takes effect. That's just essentially to let the agencies do their work and get ready for the next sections to come online. And we would begin payroll collections January 1 of 2019 and administering benefits in 2021. And then Section 22 and 23 are the captions and the effective date. So I think that brings me to the end of my testimony, and I am happy to answer questions.
Any questions at this point? Representative Bynum?
Thank you, Mr. Mm-hmm. Chair. Thank you for giving us a deep overview of the program again. So the first question I have was two. The first question I have is, can you explain the part about not dropping health insurance, whether normally I think it would kick in that after 30 days, then the employee would, after 30 days of being absent, then the employee would have to cover their premiums. So in this case, the employer would still be required to cover the premiums.
Thank you, Chair Lively, Representative Bynum. This is the provision to not drop benefits is consistent with both what's required under OFLA and FEMLA. So essentially that you can't, if an employee is out on job protected leave, you can't reduce their health insurance benefit. if an employee has a co-payment situation, they're still responsible for making their half of the health insurance payments while they're out on leave. And I think, you know, that has historically been an important part of OFLA and FEMLA, because when you're out on protected medical leave, it's arguably the most important time in your life that you need to keep your health insurance.
The second question, Mr. Sure. Chair, thank you. I was thinking about overpayments. So in the unemployment insurance system, we had in 2013, I think we had a $44 million overpayment to Oregonians, and we haven't been able to collect back on those. And so, number one, what controls would be in place to prevent overpayments? And number two, is there any thought to making sure we shore up our unemployment insurance system before we deliver these benefits as well? So that's millions of dollars that are owed the state that are not collectible at this point.
Chair Lively, Representative Bynum, I think that's a very good question. And I guess what I would say is what we have tried to do is use the existing mechanisms to get recapture overpayments. And I guess I would want to turn to one of the agencies to speak a little bit more to how that process will work exactly. But we definitely did want to be able to have a mechanism so that if there was overpayments, that collection could be sought and achieved on those. And I would say to the unemployment insurance question, I think when we thought about this and creating family benefits, in my mind, it's kind of a distinctly different purpose and need for family benefits than unemployment insurance benefits. There's sort of two different occurrences that happen in life that I think both are important social insurance programs to ensure that when those incidents happen, it's not putting a family in financial ruin.
One more question. So I guess I'm trying to understand, like, if the state is owed money, they usually will put a lien on your taxes if you're owed, and you have to pay the money back. But I guess I'm asking, there's no expectation to make sure that the state is whole on benefits that we're providing?
Representative Lively, Rep. Bynum, I guess maybe ask one of my colleagues, one of the agency folks at the Department of Revenue or Employment to speak to that, because the intent and a lot of the technical amendments that we have been doing have actually been to make sure that we are granting them the right authority to be able to collect erroneous payments, overpayments, collect from payments that haven't been made to them appropriately.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
So if not today, we'll get more information on that from Department of Revenue, probably, is who will be able to answer, but we'll make sure we have that information.
And I think everybody is in the room, or they were. So.
They left.
You're right. They left me up here.
That's right. Okay.
There are people in the room if you want that answered.
Mm-hmm. So, or we can also follow up with you.
It sounds like someone's in the room that could answer that.
Okay. Evidently, there is.
Department of Revenue.
Sorry. Hi. For the record, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Deanna Mack, Department of Revenue. And I am really sorry. I literally just walked in the room when that question was asked.
Okay.
So I heard it was about collections, but that's about it. So I really am sorry. Could you repeat the question, or can I follow up afterwards?
What would you?
Go ahead and repeat the question.
Okay.
If you can, sure.
So in the unemployment insurance program, in 2013, the state was owed $44 million-ish, according to an article. And so we've been unable to collect and pull down our receivables because probably people can't pay. I'm guessing that's the reason they aren't paying it back. But when people can't pay, we usually assess a lien on any tax returns or anything, or earnings, anything like that. We usually make efforts to get the money to recover the funds. And so in this case, I'm asking two questions. How are we going to make sure that we
prevent overpayments, that we collect them in a timely fashion, and are there any other tools that we can use to make sure that we keep the fund solvent?
So. Okay, Mr. Chair, Representative Bynum. So the Department of Revenue has two functions for collections. One, we collect the taxes owed to people, and we also have an area called our other agency accounts where we collect debt that's owed to our partner agencies, mm-hmm. like the Employment Department or DHS, OHSU, different entities around the state on their behalf. In that other agency accounts unit, we have what's called offset only collections, and we have full collections where we can issue garnishments and collect mm-hmm. on people like that. So offset only means that they're going to take, we're going to seize their personal income tax refund to pay the debt. Mm-hmm. Now, my understanding of this bill is that DCBS will be the agency that is collecting the debt, and if they cannot initially, and that they will be funneling the debt through our other agency accounts program to collect it if there is overpayments or if there is, that's my understanding. Now, I do believe that part of the section of the bill, and I don't have it in front of me, talks about how long the agencies can take to collect the debt. And I think that that component is still under, is still in being drafted. Correct me if I'm wrong on that, how that would actually work. But I imagine it would just funnel through that existing process where we would seize taxpayers' refunds if it remains unpaid. They could hire us to do full-time, full collections where we garnish and do that kind of thing, or they could just have the debt sit here and sit there for refund offset only and payments that way. But we would actively collect on it like we do any other state.
I'm going to say Chair Lively. For the record, Teresa Van Winkle, Senior Policy Advisor, Department of Consumer and Business Services. Under Section 13 as well, there is something, a directive for DCBS to waive in whole or in part any payments where recovery would be against equity and good conscience, which would help the department in establishing rules to deal with situations of this nature. And so that's one of the processes we would have to do is look at our internal, because we have collections in various aspects of our programs and how we do things and work with the Department of Revenue. Mm-hmm. So we will be looking at those sorts of situations and developing our final rules. Okay.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks a lot. Or do you want to go ahead?
I can do that, yes.
Certainly.
Thank you, Chair Lively, committee members. Again, Teresa Van Winkle from the Department of Consumer and Business Services. So I am here on oldest. You have a memorandum from Gary Homer, who is a senior economist with the department's research arm. Again, along with other agencies, DCBS has been asked to provide technical feedback on House Bill 3087. However, we are, just to be clear, we do not have a position on the bill. So before going into a little bit of detail in the essence of time, I just want to point out two things. I just want to emphasize the highlights of our department's analysis and the costs and the methodology behind that and kind of the caveats behind the estimates for the benefit costs. And also, this report does not include the estimated costs for implementation and administration, which we are currently working on right now as part of the bill's fiscal impact. So almost before we go into that. The methodology for us in doing the cost analysis is based on comparing the data and components of California's paid leave programs to the provisions of House Bill 37. And when I could say House Bill 37, like as Ms. Newhall mentioned, this would be the -1 amendment. The rationale for using California is because primarily, unlike the other states that either have fully functional paid family leave programs, or New York, who is in the process of doing implementation, Oregon does not have an existing statewide temporary disability insurance program in place. So there really isn't any claims data that is Oregon-centric. California's program has benefits that are similar in structure to House Bill 3087, and the funding mechanism is expressed as a percentage of taxable income, which is also akin to House Bill 3087. And also, because the program in California has been in existence since 2004, it provides confidence for us that the program has reached sustainability. So on the bottom of page one of the memo is a table that outlines the estimate of paid benefit costs in calendar 2021, which is the first year that House Bill 37 is allowed to process claims and the payment of benefits. Based on the latest Office of Economic Forecasts, the Department DCBS expects employment in the calendar year 2021 to be about 11% higher, and the average weekly wage to be about 22% higher than calendar year 2015. Based on those statistics and California's rates, we estimate the cost for Oregon benefits to be about $934 million for calendar year 2021, or 0.8% of total Oregon wages. To extrapolate that, a reasonable range for a one-year benefit cost estimate ranges from $748 million to $1.12 billion, which is about a 20% range. The estimate and the estimate range is subject to a volume of uncertainty that's centered on a couple of factors, such as the employee's knowledge of the paid family leave program, workplace cultures that either encourage or inhibit the program use, and the administrative complexity of obtaining benefits, and along with economic conditions. For example, from looking at existing paid family leave programs, worker knowledge is a key component to program usage and utilization rates. One study regarding California's paid family program found that fewer than one half of California workers knew about their existing paid family leave program after it's been in existence for 10 years. Unless there is widespread knowledge of the program, which I know there are components in House Bill 37 for the department and other agencies to promote the program, the initial cost may be low. Also, in regards to an employee's evaluation of using the Oregon's paid family leave program benefits against the time and cost of filing claims for benefits, such as obtaining a medical verification upon request if it is for an illness, surgery, et cetera. A worker may choose to utilize other means of paid leave. For example, if they have banked months of sick leave, they may choose to use that or other paid leave that's available currently to their employer versus tapping into House Bill 3087. Also, one of the big factors in the estimate range focuses on work leave patterns. So, for instance, the agency's analysis assumes that the average leave would be approximately 9 weeks. However, if the average leave claim ends up being 10 weeks instead of 9, this would add an estimated additional $100 million for benefit costs per calendar year. Also, employer responses will also affect the program utilization. So, for example, employers that currently have a paid family leave program separate from other existing leave that the employer provides may as a result of that and the existence of the program, employers may be encouraged to drop their existing paid family leave program instead and encourage their workers to file for the statewide claim versus other forms of leave that they have at their fingertips. Last but certainly not least, program costs will also vary with the economy. For example, a recession with job losses would lead to fewer workers that can claim benefits and also reduce the amount of benefits to fund the program since there are less workers that would tap to contributions. And also dampen increases in program costs because benefits are tied to workers' wages in the prior year. On the flip side, with an expanding economy comes strong wage growth, which results in more workers that will tap into the program, along with growth in employment levels and wages. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
So questions, I just remind people, so when she talked about the $934 million estimate, that was at the 0.8%, which the way the program is set up in this bill, they could collect up to 1.1%. So that's when you talked earlier about the early estimates show that there'd be enough money to reach what the expected payouts was when the program was to start paying out. So questions of this, the report, you do have the report in that, so we'll get another chance. You can take more look at it when we come back and next time. But if there's questions now that you'd like to ask.
Do you know when this will be scheduled for a work session?
So the next scheduled is
Tuesday the 11th.
The 11th.
But the amendments aren't ready until the time.
Right. So part of this is going to depend on when the amendments and that. Remember, we have until the 18th is the last day we can have a work session and move anything. And so since we're in that time frame, we'll have things scheduled and then keep them, if they're not that tight, move them and keep them alive until the time. Right.
And if I may, Chair Lively, I will say that Legislative Council has assured me that we'll have amendments by Monday. So we'll make that timeline.
Very good. Any other questions at this point? Okay. Thank you very much. So I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 3087 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2957. Zena.
Chair Lively, members of the committee, House Bill 2957 directs the Department of Education to award grants to school districts with an elementary school considered high poverty to enable at least one teacher for every 15 kindergarten students. It directs the State Board of Education to adopt rules and appropriates funds to the Oregon Department of Education from the general fund. There is a -2 amendment that modifies requirements for schools to receive grants. It requires schools to have a full-day kindergarten program. At least 90% of students must qualify for free or reduced lunches under federal guidelines, and the classroom must have capacity to comply. It allows the school district to apply for more than one grant. It may have a fiscal impact, but no statement has been issued, and it may have a revenue impact, but no statement has been issued.
Okay. Representative Kenny-Geyer, please.
Hi. Thank you, committee. I'm Alyssa Kenny-Geyer from House District 46, parts of Southeast and Northeast Portland. And I just wanted to give you a little bit of the history on the bill and let my two colleagues here talk more about it. This bill came to my attention from Jean Trowbridge, who you'll hear from, first grade and kindergarten teacher over time. I've gotten to know her on education policy issues for a long time now, ever since I've been in the legislature. And one of the concerns that she had brought to me, which I agreed because a lot of my background before coming to the legislature was on early childhood and child care, was the discrepancy between having for five-year-olds in the child care arena a ratio of 1 to 15, and yet we throw kids into a kindergarten classroom. We often expect a lot more. We have all kinds of standards that they have to meet, and they come from all different kinds of backgrounds. Some have been in early childhood settings, some haven't. Many have different languages, and many face poverty, and yet there are often 28, 30, sometimes 32 kids in a classroom. And it's a huge shock to kids, particularly if they haven't been in a group environment before. And there doesn't seem to be any reason for it when we have a standard, when we say what best practice is for five-year-olds in the child care arena, we hold them to a 1 to 15, and then we don't have that. So when I originally thought about this bill, it was back during the in the fall, and I believe I did an early drop of the bill that was before Measure 97 was voted on, and my thought was if indeed Measure 97 passed and we had a lot more resources than we were used to, we should have good ideas on the table about how we should spend that. And one of the things that we really need to do is look at the kindergarten ratio and how out of whack that is with what we do in the child care arena. And then I think we took a second stab at it when that measure didn't pass, and we thought we should at least try to do all kindergartens that are in Title I schools, which I believe is at 50 or 60% now of federal poverty rate. I forget. It used to be 50. I think it may have gone up. But in any case, so at least target it to all of those schools. And then I started working with Representative Hack, who got very interested in this. And we both thought she was very interested, but also very concerned about the budget. And we thought, well, let's pare it down even further and say at least let's provide a grant program that can be a pilot where we could have applications, because the first one was any Title I, and any number of schools that were Title I within that district could apply. So the Dash 2 amendment, which is basically a gut and stuff, says still has to be a 15 to 1 ratio. Schools can apply if they have 90% or higher free and reduced lunch in their school. And in a district, they may only apply for 1 to 2. The amount of money for this pilot project would obviously be however much the Ways and Means process would allow it. But it would really try to target where absolutely the need is greatest. And the other contribution that Representative Hack offered was the consideration of what's the classroom capacity size. Because if you're able to break a classroom up into two, then that's got to be one of the conditions, because we know that there are many places that would love to divide but just don't have the space. And so I really appreciate her contributions, and she wanted to be up here to help introduce this. But as you may know, she took a plane this morning to be a part of her son's college and then a leadership training thing. So sorry she's not here, but I'm delighted that both of these women are here to support and explain this House bill.
Thank you.
For the record, my name is Jean Trowbridge, and I brought Bob with me because to help us remember that we are focusing on some of the youngest children that we have in our public school systems. It's been wonderful to be able to have conversations with Representative Kenny-Geyer for the past year or two, and my approach to looking at class size and staff-student ratio has gone from, as a parent, my kids 25 years ago had kindergartens where there were EAs. Obviously, things have changed since then. So, as a parent,
education assistant.
things have changed since then. Now I am a teacher. I've been teaching for about 16, 17 years now, and for the past 14 years in the Reynolds School District in three different elementary schools, and for the past 4 years in Glenfair Elementary School. And the different ways that I have approached this have changed a lot. At first, I started with, well, here's all the research from the National Association for the Education of Children, and here's the research on class size. And people were like, yeah, that's kind of interesting, but, you know, we can't do it. And then I said, well, people keep talking about business. Let's look at this from span of control, a business concept. And the higher the greater the challenging work environment or learning environment, the smaller the span of control has to be. And learning to read and write is a very challenging endeavor, especially when you're native, when you're learning to do it in a second language or possibly a third language. And then finally, I did look at Oregon State regulations mm-hmm. for childcare and said, well, mm-hmm. here in the state, we've already determined that for a five-year-old, you should have no more than 30 kids in a class and a ratio of 1 to 15. We've already determined that that's what's you, if you're having a licensed childcare program, that that's what you have to do, but we're not doing that in our public schools. In the past few years, it has become more and more of a passion for me or compelling, and I might get agitated because I'm working in a school which is incredibly challenged. It's in the Rockwood neighborhood. It's got one of the highest concentrations of poverty in the state. It's got a very high number of children who are not native English speakers, kids who are coming from refugee camps. The number of kids in the school has grown phenomenally. We're up to 600 students. 100 of them are homeless. 50 of them live in one shelter. So the whole school itself is phenomenally stressed. And then I'd like to roll over all the testimony you heard earlier from House Bill 3067. Those kids that people are seeing in courthouses are the kids that come to school, and they've witnessed the domestic violence. They've witnessed all of those things in their homes, and they come to school, and they bring all of that with them to school. And they're in a classroom with 30 kids and one teacher. The way that they manifest their stress and the way that they manifest their traumas can be very, very disruptive in the classroom. Their needs aren't being met, and all of the way that they're acting out rolls out and ripples out to all the other students in the class. With only one adult in the classroom and 30 kids, there is no way that a teacher can support that child, that individual child's needs, as well as maintain the safety and education for everybody else in the classroom. I would have loved if this could have if we could have had the quality education model. Given that that's not the case right now, I really feel that we need to concentrate on the students that have the greatest need for this. These are kids that coming into kindergarten is often their very first exposure to any sort of group setting. That itself is traumatic, leaving their family for the first time. And they aren't kids who are getting any sort of preschool experiences. And to have them, give them the best chance to start their educational career in the strongest way possible, we need to give them the most support we can and giving them the best teacher-student ratio that we can.
Sure.
I have a quick follow-up. So the educational assistants that used to be in the classroom, mm-hmm. I don't know that they exist any place anymore, but when they were in the classrooms, so I'm just trying to understand the relationship between teacher and educational assistants. So when they were in the classroom, did that help? I mean, so if you had more than 15 students, whatever the number was, mm-hmm. did that... I'm just trying to understand. So they count like a part teacher in that, and so in theory you could have more students and still the teacher be effective if you had the assistant versus not having the assistant. I'm not clear on the role they played or didn't play.
Okay, so the existing criteria is no more than 30 and 1 to 15 in the childcare setting. In the public school setting, when it was... I don't know that there was a school cap, but there would be a teacher and an EA.
And
so... if there was somebody having a difficult time,
they could,
whether it was appropriate, if that child had a better relationship with the teacher or with the assistant, somebody could work with that child and the teacher or the other adult in the classroom could manage with other students, whether if it was a safety issue, taking them out of the room, or whether it's just being able to continue with classroom routines somewhere else while the student that needed that extra attention was able to get that from another adult. Right now what happens if we have a situation where a kindergartner is jumping off of furniture, hitting a teacher, yelling profanities, there's nobody in the room that can help, and everybody else has to experience that, and as a teacher, you have to wait till somebody can get to your room to help you deal with that emergency situation.
That's right, but we didn't have CAPS.
I don't know. Time, back then.
Right. Thank you.
Okay.
I was just a parent back then. I wasn't paying attention to those parts.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Lori?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. For your record, Lori Wimmer, representing 44,000 Oregon Education Association members, and here pleased to support 2957 with joy that it's before you, and thanks too, and sadness that we have the fiscal situation we have that makes any new idea, however fabulous, really challenging. As others have said, we have five-year-olds who go straight from either the home or a much more nurturing small ratio setting into class sizes that are, in one case, we learned as large as 55 students in a kindergarten classroom. The situation I'm thinking of is a first-year kindergarten teacher. She had two or three aides that rotated through that she, in effect, had to manage, as well as the 55 kids. It's really not just adults divided into the total number of students to get a ratio kind of situation. That's just unwieldy. That was in Medford that was the case a couple years ago during the height of our most recent recession. But we have lots of classrooms where we have students who have high ACEs scores, who come into classrooms with all kinds of problems, as you've heard. And we have situations all over the state where we're actually having to do room clears, as they call them, on a fairly regular basis, which deprives all students of a healthy learning environment for the period of time that they are sitting in the hall waiting for that to happen. We also have students who are members dubbed runners. And runners are little kids who are just so freaked out for whatever reason that they want to leave. We had a teacher in Portland who had 35 kids in her classroom. One of them was a runner. She didn't have a cell phone or a landline in her room, no aid. And she had to make a decision to either grab the kid or let him go, or abandon her kids, other 34 kids, while she chased the other kid. She did grab him, but the restraint laws are such that her principal had to report her for touching the child, and she had to go before TSPC and defend her license. We have all kinds of circumstances like that. These are real urgent situations that just break our hearts. Especially when we know from all sorts of really credible research, that my favorite is Dr. Charles Achilles' Tennessee Stars class size research that started in the 80s, but they've followed along, and now the HEROES nonprofit program is still following those same kids in high school, that made it quite clear that you get long-term rewards and results as well as short-term rewards and results for having these kinds of small class sizes, particularly in areas where students come from a lot of poverty, family dysfunction, and other such challenges. The small class sizes had high gains in test scores under the STARS research. And in the high school program that they're studying, the results show that more students from small classes enrolled in college-bound courses such as foreign languages, advanced math, and science. They had higher grade point averages, fewer discipline problems, and much lower dropout rates. So this is an investment in our chronic absentee and dropout problems in Oregon. Front-end loading that money makes a huge difference. And so with that said, I know that the challenges that you all face are grave with respect to fully funding our schools, but this is one program that we really support. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Anybody has questions?
Can I add one thing also, Mr. Chair? Thank you. Right. So we were talking about kids that come from poverty, come from families with domestic violence, the kinds of things they see in the courts, kids from different languages. The other group that I want to talk about is kids with disabilities, and there is a letter of support from an organization that deals with kids with disabilities in support of this, because we've really gone toward a policy of more inclusion, and we have more kids with physical, emotional learning disabilities, and that's made it incredibly challenging as the classroom size has gotten bigger and languages have gotten more diverse in many cases. And then we know also we had a previous hearing here where, again, Representative Hack was very concerned about what's the amount of money that follows the kid, and we know that it doesn't. There's not enough. It's not a full, if there's an IEP and there's a mandate to follow the kid, we don't have the funding to completely do that. And so another reason to make sure that when you've got a teacher in a classroom that has all of these different challenges in an era where we're going more toward inclusion, we just keep piling it on more and more. And so this is why, you know, depending on how much money we're available to do it, at least for the schools with over 90% to be able to apply, and it doesn't mean all schools with over 90% because it depends how much money would be given to this, but at least to be able to take into consideration some of the ones that have the greatest challenges and try to relieve the pressure there as the kids are transitioning into kindergarten. That would be our request.
Very good. I wish these things didn't occur. I mean, my wife that taught in grade school for 30 years, unfortunately, I saw those things. Having my youngest grandchild just get into the first grade and having worked some in my grandchildren's kindergarten classrooms, I can only tell I observed some of those things. It's just unbelievable to me, the pressure put on a teacher to have to make choices. So I appreciate the presentation and bringing the bill. It's certainly something we need to find a way to try to address. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. So I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2957. Any other business? There's not many of us left. We couldn't conduct much business. So if not, we can conduct much business. So.